Chapter 17. Nomanor left the temple square in a thoughtful mood. The temple's head priest, standing before the altar, had just delivered the message that High Priest Jakan had written on the subject of heresy, a message that all priests were ordered to repeat to all Yuuzhan Vong over the course of the next few days. Reverence of the Jedi was explicitly condemned. The congregation had been attentive, much more attentive than they would have a few days earlier, before the Shapers had produced the antifungal bomb that had relieved their itching. Nomanor, his skin no longer aflame, had listened to the message with approval, at least until the message ended and the crowd began to disperse. It was then that he realized that the priest's message had been, perhaps, a little too detailed. What Jakan had done, the executor suddenly realized, was to explain to any potential heretics exactly how to behave. The little band of heretics that Nomanor had infiltrated possessed a confused, inchoate doctrine, the elements of which they barely understood. But now it had all been explained to them. They had now been told that heretics believed that the Solo twins were emanations of the gods, that the power of the Jedi was a threat to the gods. Jakan had just defined heretical doctrine for the heretics themselves. If Nomanor should ever attend another meeting of the heretical congregation, he suspected they would have a much better idea of what they were doing. Nomanor rose from his thoughtful trance and discovered that he was leaving the temple alongside a young Shaper, one who had, judging from the freshness of the scars, only recently acquired the Shaper's specialized hand. Nomanor remembered the guarded Damutek on the fringes of the new city, the one where he'd observed Onimi, and he approached the Shaper. "Pardon me, friend Shaper," Nomanor said. "I wonder if I may have a moment of your time." "Honored, sir," the Shaper said in surprise. He had knocked out several of his own teeth and replaced them with some kind of coral implants, presumably ones that aided him in his shaping duties. Nomanor didn't really want to know what Shaper protocol required modified teeth, and he regretted the young Shaper's lisp extremely. "My name is Huli Krek, from the Damutek of the Intendants," Nomanor said. "We're from the Emergency Resources Department, and we've recently received a requisition from the office of— well, I shouldn't give the name, save to say that he's a master Shaper. Unfortunately, the requisition is couched in rather technical language, and neither I nor my superior quite understand the purpose of the requisition. He says it is important work to do with the war, but we can't quite understand what the Shaper Lord intends to do, and my superior is unwilling to release the resources until it can be made clearer." Nomanor now had the Shaper's full attention. "Yes," Nomanor thought at him, "this is all about making your caste richer." "How may I assist you, sir?" the Shaper asked. "The requisition has to do with supplies necessary in order to fulfill the directives of—" he feigned hesitation— "of something called a cortex, I believe." "A cortex is a body of Shaper knowledge," the helpful Shaper lisped. "Each cortex was delivered in the before time by the gods themselves to the Supreme Overlord or to Master Shapers." "I see," the Intendant said. "And how many cortexes are there exactly?"
"Eight."
"The eighth would be the highest, then?"
"Yes, Lord Intendant.
The eighth cortex is the supreme body of knowledge of the Shaper's art. Most of it was delivered by the gods to the Dread One Shimra himself. And he hath not yet seen fit to deliver the knowledge even to Master Shapers." Nomanor felt a chill run up his spine. "We're doomed," he thought. "Who would have thought that extinction would be heralded by such an absurd, lisping voice?" He barely managed to stammer out his thanks to the Shaper and quickly tore himself away in order to contemplate in private what he had just learned. He knew how governments worked, how else could he subvert them? And that knowledge enabled him to draw conclusions from a sprinkling of facts. The eighth cortex, the supreme knowledge possessed only by Shimra and the gods, did not exist. The Cortex Project, headquartered just beyond the city and guarded by a corps of warriors, was intended to create the knowledge, which Shimra would then deliver to his people. The Yuuzhan Vong were in a war of indefinite length, and they had run out of the knowledge that would enable them to win it. If the New Republic continued to learn and innovate, while the eighth cortex of the Yuuzhan Vong remained empty, then the Yuuzhan Vong were finished, doomed, about to be wiped from history. His mind whirled. Nomanor put a hand against a wall in order to steady himself. And if the gods, he thought in terror, have not delivered the knowledge to Shimra, then Shimra is a fraud, and so are the gods. Nomanor wanted to laugh and shriek and wail all at the same time. The greatest pillars of faith, obedience, and hierarchy, the pillars that held up the great edifice that was the Yuuzhan Vong, were nothing but a swindle. Nomanor had always suspected this, but he had never expected to have it proved. Others were staring at him, he realized. He managed to pull himself upright and put one foot in front of the other as he marched to his office. The Yuuzhan Vong needed to win the war fast, he thought, before the lack of an eighth cortex could make a difference. Nomanor would demand more information from his agents, and would sift their reports with the greatest care and diligence. He would find the enemy weaknesses and devise ways to take advantage of them. He would help the Yuuzhan Vong hammer the enemy until the enemy surrendered, or was no more. And he would also try to work out a way to use the knowledge for his own advantage, because he was, after all, Nomanor. A hollow blared in the small room, and tiny, three-dimensional figures swung their fists, heroes fighting evil in the days of the Sith. "You've returned," Verger said. "I have," Luke said, "and I brought you something." He offered a package of sweets, candies made from a Mon Calamari seaweed drizzled with a sauce of jewel fruit. "Welcome, young master," Verger cried, and took the package. "I'm afraid you won't find a file or a concealed vibroblade," Luke said. Verger, chewing candy with an expression of bliss, did not immediately reply. When she managed to speak, she said, "My debriefers seem to have run out of questions. This means that they're busy cataloging all my answers, so they can ask the questions all again and try to catch me in contradiction." There was a trace of amusement in her tone. "If I contradict myself, they prove I'm a spy, because I can't keep my story straight. Whereas if I don't contradict myself, they prove I'm a spy, because I'm too well briefed." Luke laughed to himself, imagining Idar Neely Kirka cursing as he heard this. He had just shown Luke the transcripts of Verger's interviews, all annotated for the reinterrogation. He'd now learned that Verger had anticipated his every move. Verger waved off the hollow as Luke settled onto his chair. "There's this comfort, at least," she said. "The hollows are as witless as I remember." "That must be a consolation." She peered at him. "You've come to ask a question. You owe me an answer from last time." Verger settled comfortably onto her stool and popped another candy into her mouth. "Begin, then," she mumbled. "How did you prevent the Yuuzhan Vong from finding out about your abilities? We know that Yamasks can detect Force users." "It is easier to demonstrate than to explain." She faced him directly. "Please attack me through the Force." He looked at her in surprise. "Attack you how? Mentally?" Her whiskers rippled. "If it helps, you may use a component of that anger you first brought to this room. I'll trust that you're a gentleman, and won't make it lethal." "Give in to your anger." The Emperor's seductive voice echoed in his mind. Was Verger trying to provoke him to anger, bring him to the dark side? If so, that attempt was doomed. He had withstood Vader and Palpatine when he was barely more than a boy. Now that he was a Jedi Master in the prime of life, he would hardly fall victim to such a trick. Luke turned his chair to face her and crossed his legs. The Force welled into his mind like water rising in an artesian spring. Force awareness expanded in all directions. He was aware of Idar Neely Kirka outside the room, the two techs who monitored the equipment, a prisoner in another cell, others who worked in an office just above them. He could sense the glow of their lives in the Force, hear the throb of their hearts, and time their whispering breaths. He knew that one of the techs was concentrating on a technical problem, and that his friend was daydreaming of her fiancé, who had forearms and bright blue fur, and who sent her flowers and dreams of bad poetry. But what Luke could not detect was Vergère. She seemed to have vanished completely from his Force awareness, even though he could plainly see her sitting on her stool across from him. He refined his awareness and finally detected her, a kind of fitful, uncertain presence, her life force a faint, cool phosphorescence compared to the bright candle flames of the others. Luke tried to refine his sense of Vergère to a greater degree, but she was remarkably evasive. She kept sliding away from his perceptions like a slippery melon seed squeezed between the fingers. The difficulty of keeping Vergère in focus produced in Luke a sense of frustration, which he used deliberately to fuel an attack at the elusive target, a fast, snake-like strike configured as a command simply to remain still. The mental bolt fired, but failed to find its target. He built a strike more deliberately, drawing more of the Force to power the attack, not a jab this time, but a battering ram. "Reveal yourself," he commanded, and launch the strike. Again, Vergère eluded him. His frustration rose, and he used it to power another fast strike, like a reflex, backhand blow. Nothing. Luke began to vary his attacks between massive, deliberate cannonades and swift, intuitive reflex strikes, hoping that one or the other would catch Vergère by surprise. Nothing worked. Vergère continued to sit on her stool, her reverse-articulated knees poking up above her head like knobby horns, her eyes gazing mildly into Luke's. "I can see where she is," Luke realized. He didn't have to search for her in the Force. So he built a Force wall around her, an iron box to keep her mind from slipping away, and he made up the walls of the box with a command, "Reveal yourself." After this he shrank the box, forced it smaller around Vergère's small body, molding it until it fit her form exactly, a prison to contain her spirit. And then he called more of the Force to him, building a vast mental cannonball that would obliterate anything in its path, again with the command, "Reveal yourself," and he aimed the cannonball at the tiny figure that he trapped inside the iron box. "Reveal yourself," he commanded again, and he launched the cannonball. He knew it entered the box. He knew Vergère's spirit was trapped there, boxed in, unable to move. But somehow the tiny target eluded him, and the cannonball slid away on a curving trajectory, through the wall, into the next cell, and Luke was suddenly and startlingly aware of the prisoner there, who jumped from his cot and screamed, "Yes, I confess. I stole the captain's shoes while he was drunk." Revealing himself. Luke laughed and let the Force awareness ebb to its normal level. "I'm going to get tired if I keep this up," he said. "That last one almost worked," Vergère said from around a piece of candy. "I hope you can teach this technique," Luke said. "There is more than one technique involved. I managed to evade that last strike with a kind of mental parry, as in fencing. You know how a thrust can be parried not by opposing it, but by redirecting it slightly so that it misses its goal?" "Of course. I did something similar. I added just enough mental energy to your strike to cause it to divert. The timing was very difficult to judge, and there was no small measure of luck involved in my success." "And your other techniques? Do you know the definition of a master of defense? Tell me. A master of defense is one who is never in the place that is attacked. One can move the attack, as I just did with my parry, but one can also simply not be there. Not so simply, Luke murmured. I call it making myself small. I narrow my focus bit by bit until it becomes, well, microscopic, tiny. My mind and force awareness I shrank to an infinitesimal size. An enemy has the same chance of finding me as his chance of finding one molecule amid billions of others. Your tears, Luke said. That's how you make your tears. Very good, young master, Vergeer said. Yes. In that state I can rearrange molecules, take them apart, and build new ones bit by bit. I use my tears because they are convenient, but I can accomplish the same thing with other material. I know a Jedi healer, Silgal, who would delight in this technique. I'll try to teach her, if you and she are willing. If I'm ever permitted to leave this place. You can teach without leaving this room, Luke reminded her. A sly smile drifted across Vergeer's face. I can. But will I? Vergeer gave one of her wheezing laughs and popped a candy into her wide mouth. If the military releases you from here, Luke said, will you aid us in the fight against the Yuuzhan Vong? Vergeer rolled the sticky candy into her cheek as she spoke. Insofar as it coincides with my goals, I will. Though I am much more a teacher than a warrior, and I believe my greatest objective is to help Jason to his destiny. Her eyes narrowed. I understand that he is your apprentice, not mine, and that you may have other intentions for him. I'm glad that you appreciate that. Luke had no clear idea whether he wanted to let Vergeer near Jason ever again. I think I have much to teach him. I don't want him to become dependent on you, Luke hedged. Nor do I. There was a moment of silence. Then Vergeer said, Correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding, but Jason gives me to understand that you've put restrictions on the Jedi during the course of this war, forbidding aggressive actions. I've tried to do so, Luke said, and then laughed. My success has been modest, but my understanding is that you yourself undertook offensive warfare against the forces of the late Emperor. For instance, you were part of a party that attacked the first Death Star. You led the destruction of the criminal organization of the Hutt called Jabba. You accepted military rank and participated in numerous offensive actions against the forces of the Empire and other enemies. You didn't confine yourself to spying missions and aiding refugees. All true. So my question is, what has changed? Luke paused and considered how best to marshal his arguments. The Yuuzhan Vong are a different enemy, for one thing, he began. Our special talents are ineffective against them. And, as I expressed yesterday, I didn't know what we owed a species so far outside life as we knew it. Vergeer nodded her understanding. You have heard my opinion that the Yuuzhan Vong are not outside the Force. I wonder if this has changed anything. Luke hesitated. I don't think so. The Jedi Code is clear in its statements against aggression. I know much more about the dark side than I did when I was 20. I know how easily the dark can enter. How the dark can infiltrate the heart, even when it's most certain of its own actions, and I know that many of my students aren't ready to face it. You cut off your father's hand, yes. You want to prevent your students from making the same mistakes that you have made. Of course. A disdainful look crossed Vergeer's face. That is egotism speaking. Resentment prickled along Luke's nerves. You don't know my students. You don't know how impulsive and reckless they are. Don't judge them all by Jason. He hesitated. Kip Duron killed millions.
And this was your responsibility?
Again, Luke hesitated. The situation was complex. I was paralyzed, and Kip was under the control of...
You mean to say that it was not your responsibility?
Verger interrupted, her tone harsh. I could have been more aware of the situation, Luke insisted. There's so much I could have done.
So it is your responsibility.
Interrupting again. The next time it will be, Luke insisted. The next time one of my students is swept away on a dark whirlwind and catastrophe results, it will be my fault. Verger's feathery crest rose. She smoothed it with her fingers.
Of course it would not be your fault, she said. You are a Jedi Master, not a nursemaid.
I trained them, Luke said. If their training fails, when you cut off your father's hand, was it the fault of your teachers? Verger demanded. Did Yoda fail to instruct you what dark passion could do? No, I... Frustration throbbed in Luke's heart. That's different. I, Verger mocked. I. Upon you lies the spiritual health of yourself and all those whom you taught.
Is that not ego speaking?
Luke looked at her as realization struck. You're trying to make me angry, he said.
Yes, she said simply. Did I succeed?
You did. Luke found his anger easing as he realized that Verger had been manipulating him. Though it didn't fade entirely, it still hummed, subdued, in his nerves.
I prayed upon your weakness, Verger said. I prayed upon your lack of self-knowledge, your uncertainty about where your responsibility lies for the behavior of those who have been your students.
Her piebald feathers rippled.
Was your anger dark?
It was getting there, Luke said.
So where was the darkness? In me, in you, or in the Force?
I think you've been asking too many questions. Verger sat back on her haunches.
I wondered when you were going to notice. If you have a question, ask it.
You've been saying that dark passions are caused by lack of self-knowledge. But Emperor Palpatine was dark, and I can hardly imagine that he lacked self-knowledge. He seemed perfectly comfortable within his evil. How do you reconcile this with your theory? Verger paused, assembling her argument.
Darkness enters through dark passions, she said finally. But sometimes it remains through invitation.
Palpatine, knowing himself thoroughly, may simply have decided to become dark, or to let the dark part of his own nature dominate. You're saying he may have chosen evil, coldly, not out of a hot passion.
Sometimes people make such choices.
Roger's tone was amused. Usually these people are trivial or silly.
Swearing a midnight oath, solemnly intoning, I choose evil. What a ridiculous picture. But sometimes there may be a genius who chooses to free the dark side within him. Perhaps Palpatine was one such. I cannot say I knew him only distantly, as a politician. But I can say this, the dark may enter through meditation as well as through anger.
Luke considered this. Certainly Palpatine and Vader's methods hadn't been to urge him to evil through meditation, but then, if he had joined them as their disciple, perhaps that would have come.
Have I answered completely? Verger said.
Luke nodded.
If so, Verger went on, I would ask another question. Do you think the Force cares what shade your thoughts may be?
The Force is all life. It embraces all options. But I care. Verger nodded.
A good answer, young master. Because the shades, the dark and the light and all the colors of the rainbow...
She leaned forward and tapped Luke on the breast with one hand.
They are here. Light and dark are not some great abstracts in the sky, but a part of you, and the Force reflects what it finds in you.
Later, when Luke spoke with Idar Neely Kirka, he said, "You might as well let Verger go. You're not going to get anything out of her that she doesn't want to give you."
Neely Kirka was surprised. "You're no longer worried she might be a danger?"
"It still concerns me," Luke said. "But if Verger is an enemy, we won't find out by keeping her here. We'll find out by watching what she does once she's been released."
The Temurian looked thoughtful. "I'll give your recommendation serious thought, Master Skywalker."
"If you decide to release her," Luke said, "I'd be obliged if you'd let me know first. And you could let her know my address and comm code in case she wants to speak with me."
"I'll do that."
Luke bowed. "Thank you, Commander Neely Kirka.
At your service, sir."
Luke made his way to the planet's surface, Verger's words spinning through his mind. What has changed?
Perhaps everything. "We know that there must be many refugees from Vortex on Mon Calamari," Lando Calrissian said. "And we're sure that they're in touch with your office."
"A great many of them, yes,"
said Fig Boris, the senator from Vortex. He and Lando were seated comfortably with drinks in the hotel suite Lando had rented.
"We sympathize," Lando said. "And as you know, we've brought 16 ships' worth of relief supplies to Mon Calamari to help settle the refugees here."
Ice tinkled in Boris's drink. The discreet scent of his minty cologne wafted through the air. "I'm grateful on my constituents' behalf."
"We have a problem, though, and perhaps you can help."
"How may I assist you?"
"We have the supplies, but no way to distribute them."
"What we thought we'd do is present you with 25 metric tons of supplies. You can distribute them to your constituents as you think best."
Boris's eyes grew wide. "That's certainly very generous," he managed. 25 tons? He was almost visibly calculating how much 25 tons of relief supplies was worth in the current market. With the planet's few surface areas swarming with refugees from dozens of worlds, all desperate for the most basic necessities. Boris no longer had a homeworld to return to, and without a homeworld to vote him in, he was obviously never going to be returned to the Senate. He had to think about his future.
25 tons, Lando repeated, "though there is a catch."
Boris's wide eyes narrowed to slits.
"And what might the catch be?"
"We hope to be able to sell our YVH droids to the military," Lando said. "If you can use your best efforts to vote an amendment onto the upcoming military appropriations bill, you'll find us extremely appreciative."
Boris sipped his drink carefully. "You'd best tell me about these droids."
"I have a full array of literature," Lando said, "and of course a demonstration holo."
After Boris left with an armful of data pads to distribute to his peers, Talon Card stepped from the next room.
"It's all recorded," he said.
"Boris's bribe weighs 25 tons,
Lando smiled. "It's going to be hard for him to claim it doesn't exist." Unlike the distinguished senator from Bilbringi, who, on being offered the relief supplies, simply demanded their equivalent in cash, that holo was particularly entertaining.
"Who's our next guest?" Lando asked.
Card glanced at his datapad. "Chaff Eswin from the Elrud sector."
"The Elrud sector isn't threatened by the Yuuzhan Vong. Do you think he'd have any use for relief supplies?"
"Make the offer," Card shrugged. "We can always turn it into cash later."
He looked up.
"We've also got some calls from other senators who must have heard about us from, our other clients. They're very interested in the military acquiring our droids, practically begging us to bribe them."
Lando looked at him with a growing smile.
"I think we should oblige."
Card shrugged.
"I can't think of any reason not to."
He looked thoughtful. "But I wonder, if these people are on our payroll, who else's payroll are they on?"
"That answer would be interesting, wouldn't it?" Lando said.
By the way, have you heard how Mara's doing? Not yet, but I hope to hear from her soon.
Mara was, in fact, doing well. She had taken YVHM-1 out for its maiden Yuuzhan Vong hunt, wandering government buildings and large public concourses. She lunched at a kiosk set up in a shopping concourse and then sat down to digest and to watch the passers-by. She told the droid to search on its own. She was distracted by the sight of a pair of children. Children Ben's age, taking their first hesitant steps in the open-air creche the concourse provided as a convenience to its customers. Sadness rose in Mara and took her by the throat. For a moment, she missed Ben so much that it was almost a physical pain. And then the mouse droid signaled her portable comm. Mara looked up from the creche, startled. The mouse droid signaled again. The droid had located a Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator, or at least someone the mouse droid claimed was a Yuuzhan Vong. Mara asked the droid for a homing signal and followed it until she saw the person in question. A tall, rather broad female human, inconspicuously dressed, who wandered seemingly at random along the shopping galleries. Mara called the force into her mind, letting the lives of all the thousands of living beings in the concourse flood into her awareness. All the beings save one. Her target was a cold void in the Force, an emptiness that Mara had learned to associate with the Yuuzhan Vong.
"Good work, Mousie," Mara said.
Mara was plainly dressed, in worn robes such as a refugee might wear, with a hood that she could wear over her overly conspicuous red hair. She altered the hood with a floppy-brimmed hat in order to change her silhouette, and she carried a data pad through which she could issue commands to the mouse droid and also view what the droid was seeing. She followed the target at a distance and let the droid do most of the spying for her. The target wandered through the shopping concourse for 20 minutes or so, and then sat on a bench as if to take a rest. At this point, Mara managed to get the droid close and behind the bench, just in time to observe the target reach beneath the seat and peel off something that had been stuck there. "Aha!" Mara thought delightedly. This was better than getting an idiot's array at Sabacc. The target lumbered to her feet and strolled down the concourse. Mara drifted after. The target paused a moment by a vending machine, then continued on. When Mara purchased a snack from the machine and looked behind her, she saw something stuck there with an adhesive. It was just the size of a bundle of credits. Mara decided to let the mouse droid follow the Yuuzhan Vong and to wait near the vending machine for whoever was scheduled to pick up his payment. She perched on a store windowsill and ate her snack, which was some kind of fried salted seaweed that tasted of iodine and was obviously intended for a Mon Calamari palate. Within an hour, the money was picked up by a Sulliston male, who used part of the cash immediately on a flashy new jacket purchased in one of the most exclusive boutiques in the arcade. The Sulliston then returned to work, which turned out to be in the building the Senate had requisitioned for its offices. Mara discovered that the Sulliston worked in the office of Senator Carl Pragett, a member of the Security and Intelligence Council. Most interesting, Mara thought. She then caught up with the mouse droid, which had followed the suspected Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator to an apartment building. Mara made a note of the address and then called Idar Nilikirka on her comm and told him to buy as many of the mouse droids as Lando and Talon Card had available. YVHM-1 had proved its worth on its very first day. Kola Quist dropped out of the race for chief of state following a ringing endorsement for Cal Omis, who had quietly promised him chairmanship of the Commerce Council, mid-level ministry jobs to several of his friends, and a branch office of the Kelmer Institute for Ryloth. On the next vote, Cal added enough votes to raise his percentage to 35. Not all of Quiss's supporters followed his lead, however, and Fior Rodan picked up another couple of percentage points and stayed in the lead with 37. Poe held steady with 3 votes total.
Tollum Ranth added enough to his total to raise his percentage to 22, which meant that the soft-spoken, exquisitely polite Gotal chairman of the Justice Council now controlled enough votes in the Senate to deliver the election either to Cal Omis or to Fjord Rodan. Ranth was now being courted in earnest. Tons of refugee supplies were shipped to the planet's surface from the smuggler fleet overhead. The new military appropriations bill, with riders attached, involving the purchase of thousands of YVH droids, passed out of the Defense Council and onto the Senate floor. The Senate, urged by all three candidates to act quickly, passed the bill, with only a few token attempts at adding amendments to earmark funds for a particularly worthy planet or cause or brother-in-law. Mara found a second Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator. She and a squad of mouse droids and Neely Kirka's agents began mapping the two infiltrators' contacts and associates. Primary residences and safe houses were located, and eavesdropping devices quietly inserted. Considering the alarming implications of everything she was discovering, Mara was having a strangely pleasant time.
Every morning, I want every person in my command to ask himself the same question. And that question is, how could I hurt the Yuuzhan Vong today?
Admiral Trieste Kriefe was visiting every ship in his command, first to conduct an inspection and then to address ship personnel. He was speaking from the enlisted mess of Starsider, a room large enough to contain all the fleet personnel who were stationed, or passing through, or barracked, on the old dreadnought. Jaina, flanked by Kip and Lobaka, sat at a table on one edge of the room, watching the white-furred Bothan bound up and down on his speaker's platform. Kriefe was in good spirits today, and his body language showed it. He bounced on the balls of his feet as he repeatedly punched the air to emphasize his points, and his fur continually peaked and smoothed with surges of emotion.
"And if you can't find a way to hurt the Vong," the Admiral continued, "I want you to ask yourself this question. How can I help my own side grow stronger?"
"At least its leadership," Kip said, his murmur pitched to carry only to the ears of his fellow Jedi. "It's not like we've seen a lot of leadership in this war."
"Maybe it's a little more leadership than we need," Jaina murmured in answer.
Loey knew better than to say anything himself. His translator droid lacked discretion and would probably shout the translation out at full volume, but he allowed himself a small moan of agreement.
"We're going to win the war of production," Kriefe proclaimed. "Our factories are building more starfighters, more capital ships, and more weapons than ever before. Our schools are turning out more pilots and other personnel. Within months, we'll have replaced all the terrible losses we've suffered so far in this war."
Jaina thought of Anakin and Chewbacca, and Annie Capstan and others, the millions who'd lived on Cernpadal and Ithor. Unique, individual beings, alive and responsive to the other lives around them. Replaced? No one could replace any of them.
"That trip to Bathawi has changed the Admiral," Kip said. "He used to be a lot less bouncy."
"The Bothans declared our cry and removed any necessity for moral responsibility," Jaina said. "I imagine that could cheer a person up."
"We're going to smash the Vong," Kriefe proclaimed. "We're going to smash them every day. We're going to smash them until there are no more Yuuzhan Vong."
The room erupted in applause. Jaina and the other Jedi remained silent. After Kriefe's speech had worked its way to a rousing conclusion, Jaina was stopped at the exit by one of the Admiral's aides.
"Major Solo," he said, "the Admiral would like to see you."
Kriefe met Jaina in an office loaned him for the purpose by Starsider's captain. Kriefe was still clearly exhilarated from his speech, still bouncing energetically on the balls of his feet. His vicinity smelled very strongly of excited Bothan.
"I saw you in the audience, and I thought I'd have Snade pull you in for a chat."
"Very good, sir."
Which seemed a proper sort of thing for a bewildered officer to say. Chats with admirals were a rarity in her experience. Kriefe's whiskered face beamed. Did you like the speech?
Jaina answered truthfully. I thought it was the strongest speech I've heard in this war, sir.
At least it said most of the right things.
Creefe was impressed. Coming from Leia Organa's daughter, I'll take that as a very special compliment, indeed.
My mother hasn't had many chances to make speeches lately, sir,
Jaina said. Regrettably true.
Creefe paused, his furred hand brushing the polished tabletop.
I thought, he began, that I would send you to see your brother.
Sir?
Jaina was almost speechless with delight.
She could see Jason, touch him,
feel his mind floating toward her in the twin bond.
Colonel Darklighter tells me that you've been in continuous action against the enemy for many months. You deserve a rest, but the war hasn't been able to spare you. But things have grown quiet with both sides reorganizing after Coruscant, and we can spare you now. So I'm going to send you on a furlough to Moon Calamari for 2 weeks. He drawled out the last words, then raised a finger and pointed at Jaina. But you're going on a special mission for me, understand?
Jaina tried her best not to stare at him.
No, sir, she said. I don't understand.
You said that you needed more Jedi for your experiment in Force Meld to work. I want you to talk to your mother, to your Uncle Luke, and I want you to get me those Jedi. I want to put those Jedi in my ships and have them link through the Force in combat.
He grinned.
What do you think?
I'll do my best, sir, but...
Protests rose reluctantly into her mind. My squadron's been completely reorganized in the last month, sir. I have 2 brand new pilots fresh out of flight school. Another 4 who've only been with us a few weeks. We haven't flown together long enough to...
I need time, sir. I'm afraid my squadron can't spare me.
Your number 2 can take over for a few weeks,
Creefe said.
He's another Jedi, isn't he? The Wookiee?
Yes, but he's busy with his team investigating Trickster.
His team can do without him for a few hours every day. I want you on Moon Calamari finding Jedi for me.
He smiled kindly.
And getting some rest, of course. You've been working too hard, like all of us.
He rose, and Jaina realized the audience was over. She stood and saluted.
I'll have Snaid draw up your orders, Creefe said. You're to leave tomorrow.
Very good, sir.
Soon she could see Jason. The next day, as she set out in her X-Wing for Mon Calamari, Twin Sun's squadron soared past her, brilliant in the light of Kashyyyk's sun, and tipped their wings in salute before cutting in their engines and flashing away out of sight. She felt like a traitor for leaving them behind. The rookies needed much more training before they'd have a chance of surviving against the Yuuzhan Vong, and she wouldn't be there to supervise it. What if one of them died because of something she hadn't been present to teach them? What if the whole squadron was led to disaster because of something she could have prevented? Jaina had every faith that Loey would do a good job as squadron commander, but it wasn't Loey's squadron. It was hers. Whatever happened to it, it was she who was responsible. Jaina sighed, settled into her molded seat, and began plotting the first of the long series of jumps that were calculated to avoid the dangerous parts of the wide Yuuzhan Vong-occupied swath of worlds between Kashyyyk and Mon Calamari. She thought about seeing Jason again, and all her doubts faded.
"Welcome, Senator." Lando, smiling broadly, shook Thig Boris's hand and escorted him to an armchair. "I'd like to express my admiration on the rapidity with which your committee dealt with the YVH amendment."
"A surprising number of my colleagues were in favor of the amendment," Boris said. "An unsubtle number, perhaps."
"These days," Lando said, "a person with tons of relief supplies can't help but make a lot of friends."
"You're giving away enough. The price of basic commodities has dropped enormously in the last few days."
"But surely that's a good thing, Senator," Lando said.
"No doubt." Boris gloomed.
Lando and Card had so flooded the market with relief supplies that the senator's illicit profits were barely keeping ahead of the costs of warehousing everything he was secretly offering for sale. Cheaters never prosper, Lando thought virtuously. I thought we might discuss the future of our relationship, Lando said, and seated himself adjacent to the senator.
I hope you're not going to offer me more relief supplies.
Lando steepled his fingertips and tried to ignore Boris's nose-tickling, minty cologne. What I hoped, he said, was to discuss the next chief of state.
I'm committed to Fjord Rodan, as you know.
I was hoping to change your mind.
That's not possible, Boris said shortly. I've made a definite commitment.
I regret that extremely, because it's then possible that people may see this holovid.
He touched the control of the room's holoprojector, and Boris watched with increasing petulance at the sight of himself in his first meeting with Lando.
"You can't release that," he snapped finally. "If I'm guilty of taking a bribe, which I'm not, then you're guilty of offering one. To release that holo would be to put your own head into the noose."
"I would never claim that I bribed you," Lando said with indignation. "I've never bribed anyone in my life."
"Then what's all this about?" Boris snarled.
"I gave you the supplies to be given free to refugees," Lando said. "That's very clear in the hollow. If it could be demonstrated that you were selling the supplies instead of giving them away, then that would be, why, it would be illegal, wouldn't it?"
Boris stared at Lando with burning hatred in his eyes.
"Now," Lando said with a perfect white smile, "about the next chief of state." The next 3 days saw an extraordinary number of defections from the camp of Fjord Rodan. Not just those who had allowed themselves to be bribed, but others whose activities had been revealed by a little of Talon Card's research. Those who stole fleet elements in order to make their escape from Coruscant, or who called for the fleet to escort them to safety while other naval units, deprived of support, stayed and died. There were those who had sprung criminals from custody on condition that the criminals helped them escape the Yuuzhan Vong. Others had taken massive bribes in order to take world-class criminals off-planet. There was one senator who had left his whole family behind in order to provide transport to a well-fed Coruscant plutocrat and his harem of mistresses. Some of these, the supporters for Rodan most counted on, were persuaded to announce publicly that they had changed their minds and intended to vote for Cal Omis. The following morning, Mara, now operating with a pair of YVHM mouse droids, picked up a Yuuzhan Vong infiltrator at her place of residence and followed her through refugee-packed streets toward the edge of Herkia Floating City, where gracefully curved seawalls kept the green ocean rollers from sweeping right up the streets. The Yuuzhan Vong wasn't interested in the view, but walked along the base of the seawall to a bubble-topped structure that projected out over the water. When the target entered, Mara remained outside and sent one of the mouse droids through the broad, open doorway. The structure proved to be a private marina, with boats and submersibles of various sizes moored in long rows of slips. The Yuuzhan Vong spoke to a Quarren who sat behind a desk near the entrance, and the Quarren handed her what might have been a set of keys. The infiltrator then walked out onto one of the jetties. Mara left her second droid near the entrance and entered the marina herself. The salt and iodine scent of the sea was strong in the confined space. The Yuuzhan Vong, she saw, was inspecting a submersible. Drawing the hood of her robe forward to partly mask her face from the Vong, Mara approached the Quarren.
"Do you rent submersibles here?" she asked.
"No," the Quarren said. "We rent berths to private vehicles only." One of his facial tentacles pointed politely toward the door. "If you want to rent submersibles, you can turn right at the entrance, then walk along the seawall to..." Mara's comm unit chittered at her. "Excuse me," she said, and stepped away from the desk just as a large human male walked into the building. The new arrival blinked as his eyes adjusted to the relative darkness inside the covered marina, and during that time Mara read the information that her mouse droid was trying to tell her.
The new arrival was another Yuuzhan Vong. Mara's heart leapt. She turned her head away from the new arrival and tried to shrug into her hood. It wasn't as if Mara Jade Skywalker wasn't someone an enemy infiltrator might recognize at close range. But the infiltrator wasn't interested in her, or in the Quarren. Without looking left or right, the Yuuzhan Vong marched into the building, walked down the long jetty, and joined the first Vong. Frantically, Mara considered her options. For years, she had been the Emperor's hand. She had lived as a spy, infiltrator, and assassin, and she understood spy work well. Two Yuuzhan Vong infiltrators meeting face-to-face violated every single principle of tradecraft. If the two needed to speak, they could do so by Villip with complete privacy. If Villips weren't available, they could use dead letter drops or, with precautions, simple comm units. There were three possible reasons why the two Yuuzhan Vong were meeting face-to-face. They could be stupid. They could be overconfident. Or third, something was happening that was of such overwhelming importance that the Yuuzhan Vong were forced to throw all caution to the winds and conduct the operation together. Mara knew which way she wanted to bet. The Yuuzhan Vong had opened the cockpit of their submersible and were descending into it. Mara returned to the Quarren at the desk. "Are you sure you don't have any submersibles for rent?" she asked, and made a gesture with one hand. "Yes," the Quarren said. "We have submersibles for rent. I want a fast one, and I need it immediately." The Quarren reached beneath the desk and produced a set of keys. "Berth 5B, ma'am," it said. "Thanks," Mara said, snatching the keys. The face tentacles waved goodbye. "Have a nice voyage." The Yuuzhan Vong were swinging their cockpit closed. Mara tried to avoid a dead run as she headed for berth 5B. Her submersible was a slim sport model, whose sleek lines showed the customary Mon Calamari attention to elegant design. The transparent cockpit seated two passengers, one behind the other, and the deep green paint job featured a scalloped pattern that suggested fish scales. Mara cast off the two mooring lines, then put a foot on the submersible and felt it bob under her. She keyed the lock, and the bubble canopy rolled aside with a hydraulic hiss. Mara vaulted easily into the pilot's seat and found the main power switch. She pressed it, and the instrument panel came to life. The instrument panel was simple compared to that found in a starfighter. Mara pulled away a drape of her cloak that had caught on the cockpit combing, then closed the canopy. Canopy locks clamped down to make the sub watertight. Ventilators whirred as they automatically switched on. Mara engaged the engine, and water jets hissed as Mara backed out of the slip. The Yuuzhan Vong craft, she saw, was already moving through the seaward entrance of the marina and into the open sea. Mara kicked the rudder over and accelerated, shaving the stern of the nearest vessel by millimeters as she set out in pursuit. She zigzagged around the piers and dashed through the exit to see the first ocean wave break over the Vong's canopy as it began to descend. Mara steered after the vanishing craft and looked for the ballast tank controls. Air sputtered from vents as she began her descent. Piloting the submersible, she found, was like flying a starfighter, but in slow motion. It rolled and banked like any atmosphere craft. And, like any atmosphere craft, it flew better when it was in trim. The ballast tanks filled equally fore and aft, which meant she didn't have to be constantly fighting the dive planes to keep the boat at the right depth. Visibility was quite good, but good visibility in the water only extended 100 meters or so. Fortunately, her displays kept her informed of other craft in the water. Radio-based detection systems were useless in the water, so submersibles featured a system based on sound. Rather than having every underwater craft pinging away all the time and confusing each other's sensors with overlapping noise, Herkia Floating City itself issued regular low-frequency sonar pulses that highlighted every craft in the vicinity for 30 kilometers or more. In order to detect the vessels around them, all the submersibles had to do was set their own sonar sets to passively receive the city's pulses. Mara had no trouble following her target,
and doing it without calling attention to herself, though she did speed up at one point in order to make certain that the craft she was following was the right one. She crept up on its tail until she recognized the configuration of the cabin, then allowed her boat to drift back. Compared to her own, the Yuuzhan Vong boat was a squat, broad, roomy vessel, with its two passengers sitting abreast of one another, and she reckoned her own tube-shaped craft was much speedier. This and the usefulness of Herkia's city sonar allowed her to keep her distance from the Yuuzhan Vong vessel, even to join other traffic patterns, in order to make it less obvious to the Vong they were being followed. The target vessel plodded on at a deliberate speed, descending to 35 meters and circling the floating city until it was almost directly opposite the marina from which it had started. At this depth, all color faded away to blue or gray, except for the occasional silver flash of a predator fish darting at the smaller fish attracted by the brightly lit windows of the residential areas. Below, the sea was a profound deep blue that seemed to stretch down forever, an azure vastness that seemed as limitless as empty space. The Yuuzhan Vong boat checked its speed and began to hover. Mara slowed her own vessel, uncertain what she could do without giving herself away. If she began to hover herself, it might make the Yuuzhan Vong suspicious, but so might tracking back and forth in their vicinity. Instead, she decided to pass within visual range of the target and see if she could make any sense of its actions. She dipped the dive planes to pass under the Vong craft, and set the throttle to a slow rate of speed to give herself as much time in visual range as possible. Then she almost jumped out of her skin as she passed in front of one of the city's sonar emitters and felt the deep, low-frequency rumble as it shivered along her bones and caused her boat's small metal fittings to rattle. The squat form of the target submersible loomed up, silhouetted against the bright blue and silver of the ocean surface 35 meters above. The Vong boat had its stern to the open ocean, its bow toward the floating city, and it was simply hovering in place. Mara peered up at the boat, unable to see much of anything along its dark underside. But then, through the perfect acoustic medium of the water, she heard the hum of an electric motor, and with it a brief scraping. The sounds repeated themselves. This time, as she gazed up at the Yuuzhan Vong vessel, she caught a brief movement from the bows, a kind of dimple that appeared on its port bow, to match an identical dimple on the starboard side. And then her blood froze with horror at the realization of what she had just seen. The Vong boat had opened a pair of torpedo tubes. It was about to open fire on Herkia floating city. But why, she thought. Herkia was colossal. A pair of torpedoes couldn't possibly sink it. Mara's head cranked to port, staring in consternation at the face of the city, at the series of clear windows that gave out onto the ocean deep, and there, silhouetted, she saw her answer, the tall, shaggy form of a Wookiee. Tribach. Tribach, gazing out of the sweating, transparasteel wall of Cal Omis's apartment. Cal, the chief of state candidate most likely to carry on the war against the Yuuzhan Vong. And Tribach was soon joined by another lanky figure that Mara recognized at once. Cal Omis. Cal and Tribach continued to stand by the viewport. Mara realized they were holding drinks. Perhaps they had something to celebrate. The Yuuzhan Vong boat swam into view dead ahead. Mara's boat had no weapons, no torpedoes of her own, but on the other hand her craft was a weapon. It weighed a metric ton or more, and it was moving fast, and if she couldn't sink her enemy by ramming, she might be able to disable it. Mara rolled her sub more or less upright and fed power to the water jets as she aimed her vessel at the enemy canopy, descending on the Yuuzhan Vong craft from above its starboard quarter. If she could smash into the canopy, the enemy would probably be killed outright, and at any rate would drown. Pull up! Pull up! Collision alert! Pull up! Mara's nerves jumped as a roaring voice filled the cockpit, and her vessel's passive sonar went active with a series of high-pitched warning screeches aimed at alerting her target to its danger. The controls bucked in her hands as an autopilot seized control of the vessel. Grimly, she fought the controls as she tried to keep her craft
aimed at the enemy, while her eyes scanned the controls for a switch to turn off the autopilot.
Pull up. Collision alert. Pull up.
Things happened too fast for Mara to locate the autopilot override. There was an impact, then a scraping sound as her submersible rolled over the enemy craft. Her boat slewed violently to port as her aft port dive plane caught on the Vong's dorsal rudder. Locked together, the two subs whirled around each other, then parted with a grinding shudder. Mara looked over her shoulder to see the Vong sub inverted and pitched nose down. Cavitation bubbles sprang from its jets as it tried to right itself. One of the Yuuzhan Vong, thrown against the canopy by the impact, glared at her with his false human face distorted by a furious rage. Mara sensed that Calomus and Tribach weren't running away. They were peering out the viewport, trying to make out what had just happened in the deep, distant blue of the water. Then the enemy faded into the darkness as Mara's boat sped away. Mara fought the controls to pull her boat around for another pass. Her port dive plane had deformed with the impact. She could hear the hiss and squelch of water as it passed roughly over the distorted surface, and feel the sideways slowing motion that the distortion imparted to her craft. Then suddenly she heard a whoosh and a frantic pinging, and her nerves keened with the knowledge that the Vong had just fired a torpedo. Her force sense told her that it was aimed at her, not at Calomus. She could sense the mass of the torpedo as it neared, and hear the increasingly fast Doppler-shifted chirps of its active sonar as it sped closer. Mara yanked the craft to port, hoping that the drag of the distorted port dive plane would assist her in making a tight turn. At the same time, she pushed out with the force, trying to shove a stream of water at the torpedo to push it off to the right. The torpedo sizzled past Mara less than 2 meters beyond the sub's starboard dive plane, and Mara felt herself brace against the power of the explosion that would come with the detonation of a proximity fuse. But the torpedo must have had a contact fuse that ignited only on impact, because the underwater missile sped on, its frantic sonar pings dopplering lower in pitch as it raced away. Mara gazed at her displays and discovered the Vong craft lumbering in a turn, trying to bring its second and last weapon to bear on Calomus. Mara fought the damaged dive plane, lifted the sub's nose, and straightened once she'd gained 5 meters of altitude above the enemy boat. She could see no way to disable the autopilot that would try to interfere with her ramming maneuver. Either it wasn't possible, or it required codes she didn't have. She would have to anticipate the autopilot's taking over this time, and take its interference into account as she held her course against the enemy. As she pushed the throttles forward, she realized that the fast pinging behind her had shifted, then began to pitch higher in volume. The torpedo had turned around and was coming at her again. The Vong craft loomed ahead, still turning to bring its torpedo to bear on the floating city. The pings behind Mara grew more frequent and higher in pitch. She pushed her throttle to maximum speed and dived down onto the enemy boat, water hissing through her jets.
Dive! Collision alert! Dive! Collision alert!
This time the autopilot was trying to pitch her downward to let her craft slip below the enemy. She fought the controls, trying to keep her machine on target.
Dive! Dive!
The pinging from astern beat faster than Mara's heart. Mara felt her sub shudder at the contradictory commands given the control surfaces, sensed the mass and speed of the torpedo approaching, and then she took her hands off the controls and let the autopilot take over. The damaged dive plane screwed the sub around to port as it dived beneath the swollen shadow of the enemy craft. Mara saw the looming shadow of the Yuuzhan Vong sub's rudder dead ahead, cutting toward her cockpit like a huge knife. But the drag from the damaged dive plane pulled her out of the way with millimeters to spare. The torpedo was so close that Mara could hear its hiss as it shot through the water. And then the torpedo hit the Yuuzhan Vong craft dead astern as Mara's boat slid underneath, and a great watery hand took Mara's sub and flung it spinning through the sea. Her hands and feet worked the controls as she tried to stabilize her craft, as she tried to gain her bearings in the giant white boil of the explosion. Mara managed finally to bring her craft to a hover. She was hanging upside down in the cockpit,
one of her legs clamped hard on her seat, and the other braced under the instrument panel. With careful squirts of her maneuvering jets, she managed to roll her sub upright. To one side, she could see the wreckage of the shattered Yuuzhan Vong craft spin downward into the blue depths below. The great mass of the floating city, on her other side, seemed intact. Tribok and Cal were gone from the viewport, and through the roiling sea she could barely make out the apartment's front door. Ajar, the two had fled. "Finally figured out what those fast pings meant, eh?" she thought. "Well, better late than never." Luke, alerted once Mara got to the surface, stashed Cal Omis in their own apartment, which, with Jason still there, was getting a little crowded, but was at least above water and in a part of the city with better security. Lando shipped down a pair of YVH droids for safety's sake, and, out of the presumed goodness of his heart, offered security droids to the other candidates as well. Idar Neely Kirka managed to get Mara out of the trouble she was in for stealing a submersible and getting it damaged during the course of an underwater dogfight. Mara arrived at her apartment late in the evening to discover why Cal Omis and Tribok had been celebrating. On a vote held earlier that day, Cal had jumped into the lead with 46%, followed by Fjord Rodan with 24, and Talam Ranth with 20. Pwo had actually gained a vote for a total of 4. "Suddenly Talam's 20% isn't worth as much to him," Cal told Mara. "I don't have to promise him much, because his supporters are going to defect in droves in the hope that I'll be grateful later." He looked puzzled. "What I can't work out is how Fjord's supporters turned out so wobbly." He glanced at Luke. "You didn't somehow arrange this, did you?"
"No," Luke said.
Cal grinned.
"I didn't think Jedi mind control worked as well as that. I guess Fjord's supporters found out something about him that might be embarrassing if it got out, and decided to jump ship while they could."
"I didn't arrange it," Luke said, "but I think I know who did." Mara gave him a sharp look. "I'm not the only one who's been having adventures," she thought. Cal's grin faded. "Should I know about this?" he asked.
"Absolutely not," Luke said. "But I wouldn't count on Fjord's defectors for anything more than getting you into office. My guess is they're good for one vote only. If I were you, I'd court Talam Ranth and as many of his people as you can, because you're going to need them later."
Cal rubbed his chin. "I'm not going to ask any more questions."
"You're an intelligent man," Luke said. "You'll work it out without my help."
By that point, Mara had worked it out herself. The next day, Talam Ranth released his followers to vote for Cal Omis, and Cal was elected with almost 85% of the vote. Fjord Rodan and a few diehards refused to make the vote unanimous, and three loyalists still voted for Pwo. Cal moved off Mara's sofa and to the suite reserved for the new chief of state at Herkia's Pashist Hotel, where he was ably guarded by a platoon of YVH droids. He began working on the acceptance speech he would have to give the Senate the next day. But before he began, he signed the order creating the new Jedi Council, with Luke at its head.